Lecture 8, The Third Reich, World War II, and the Holocaust.
We concluded with the outbreak of the Second World War. I'm not a military historian. I'm not going to take us through a blow-by-blow or even attempt to take us through a blow-by-blow account of the changing tides of battle and so on in the war. But to try to bring these two themes that we've raised in the previous sessions this morning together, that is the National Socialist ideological drive for expansion in the East, the desire to create a Grossdeutsches Reich that would be economically self-sufficient, a crusade against Bolshevism in the East, and finally, the attempt on the part of the Nazis to create that empire in a racial way, to create a new order in Europe. The war began, as we know, in September of 1939 with the German attack on Poland. The assault would be followed by declarations of war. Germany would be at war first with Britain as well as with France. Hitler had moved against Poland with a number of assumptions, one of which was that the West wouldn't fight. When Hitler was apprised of the British decision to honor its obligation to Poland, Hitler is said to have turned to Ribbentrop and have said, "What now?" Because Ribbentrop had so assured him that the British would not fight. Hitler clearly had not intended a war against the West in 1939. He believed that he had achieved the diplomatic isolation of Poland. He believed that the alliance with the Soviet Union would prevent Western intervention, and was therefore quite startled to discover that the West was indeed prepared to honor its obligations to the Polish state. Moreover, the German economy, despite all of the parades of military hardware in Berlin that had become a staple of National Socialist ritual, the German economy was not in any position to mount a long war. All the preparations had been made for short engagements. Hitler had pursued a policy of armaments in breadth, not in depth. His whole plan, both in terms of military strategy as well as economic strategy, had been focused on something that came to be known as the Blitzkrieg, a lightning war in which the military would, in a lightning flash, deal a knockout blow to a diplomatically isolated opponent, and that the German economy could then maintain itself on a kind of peacetime footing. Hitler was tremendously sensitive to the sorts of privations that he believed had helped bring about the revolution of 1918 and bring the old regime in Germany down, and he didn't want to see the German people put in that position again. The Blitzkrieg was, of course, based on the notion of a coordinated use of armor and air power to attain a lightning victory while maintaining business as usual on the home front. The war against Poland was over in less than a month. I think we've all seen those terrible photographs of Polish cavalry units charging off on horseback to engage German armored divisions as they rolled into Poland. But there was something about that first campaign, the very first campaign of what would be the Second World War, that already suggested a tremendous difference between that and the First War. And that was the German air attack on Warsaw. This was going to be a war in which civilian populations were not spared, a war that would be total in a way that the first had only threatened to become. The Poles were, of course, knocked out of the war by October, and the Germans began plans for an assault on Western Europe when it became clear that France and Britain would not back down. In April of 1940, there was a German invasion of Norway and Denmark to protect the northern flanks of the country. But all across the Western Front, one has this curious situation of the so-called phony war. with Britain and France and Germany technically at war, but no major engagements between the two. And indeed, a number of diplomatic initiatives back and forth at this time, particularly from the German side, to see if it might not be possible to avoid conflict in the West. The phony war came to an abrupt end in May of 1940 when German units attacked all across the Western Front. By May 20th, German troops had reached the Channel, the miracle of Dunkirk that I think we all know about coming in late May, early June of 1940. On June 14th, the fortress of Verdun, which the Germans had attempted to take in 1916 during the First War, fell into German hands, as did Paris. On June 22nd, a Franco-German armistice was signed, Hitler going to Paris, and in fact bringing out of the French Military Museum the same French rail car in which the Germans had been forced to surrender in November of 1918 to complete the humiliation of the French. Hitler was, at this point, probably at his most popular in Germany. The announcement of the outbreak of the war had not led to a replay of the scenes of July and August 1914, when the German population was informed that Germany was at war with Poland on September 1st. Hitler was furious because the scenes of civilians turning away from the military units that moved through the streets of Berlin. We know that Hitler was tremendously unhappy, that there was no sort of surge of euphoria. There was an awful sense in Germany that finally Hitler had miscalculated and war had come. The victory over France, however, resulted in a surge of popularity for Hitler once again in Germany, a sense that, well, the war was at last over, that the British had managed to creep back to England, but that Germany was now the hegemonic power on the continent, and that something that the imperial government had failed in 4 years to do, that is, to knock France out and seize Paris, the Nazis had managed in a matter of weeks. In July of 1940, the German High Command began preparations for something called Operation Sea Lion, which was an amphibious landing in Britain, an attack on Britain. And between August 7th and September of 1940, German planes began what was to be the establishment of air superiority over the Channel and came to be known as the Battle of Britain. That assault began with an attack of 15,000 German planes on the first day of this protracted engagement. But in the end, and one can talk, there all of these things swirl in controversy. The Battle of Britain, however, as we know, ended with the failure of the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force, to establish the necessary air superiority over the Channel. And it ended any serious plans for an invasion of Great Britain. But the Battle of Britain also helped to change the nature of the war, because during the Battle of Britain, Germany had shifted its primary targets away from airfields and military targets and had begun to bomb civilian populations in Great Britain. And on August 31st, the British launched the first air attack on Berlin. This came as a tremendous shock to the Germans. Here they were, masters of the European continent. The British, they believed, were hanging on by a fingernail, and the British had launched this attack on the capital city. Molotov, who was visiting Berlin on that day and had to be taken down into a bomb shelter in the Foreign Office, had just been told by Ribbentrop that, well, not to worry, that the British had been knocked out of the war. And Molotov is said to have responded, well, if they're knocked out of the war, why are we down here in the air raid shelter? And they're up there. Nonetheless, Hitler very quickly gave up on his plans for an invasion of Britain, and he gave up on them because Hitler never really had much of an intention or much of an interest in an invasion of Britain. For Hitler, the war in the West was always a mistake. It was something that was never intended to happen. The real objective, the real goal, was in the East. And he couldn't understand why the British couldn't come to terms with this. So that after the failure of the German Air Force to secure the necessary preconditions for an invasion of Britain, Hitler very quickly shifted his priorities once again and came back to that objective that was close closest to his heart and at the core of National Socialist ideology, an invasion of the Soviet Union. In December of 1940, the High Command was ordered to begin plans for an invasion of the Soviet Union, which was dubbed Operation Barbarossa, after the medieval German emperor who had engaged in this Drang nach Osten, or this drive to the east. The offensive in the Soviet Union was planned for the spring of 1941. The Germans were to take advantage, intended to take advantage of early spring weather, to move in after the thaw, and to campaign through the summer, reaching Moscow sometime in the late summer. The Soviet Union, they expected, would collapse. There would probably be a revolution to overthrow the Bolsheviks, and the campaign would also be a blitzkrieg type of affair. Unfortunately for Hitler's calculations, Mussolini's misadventures in Greece led to a German intervention in April of 1941. The Germans moved into Yugoslavia and Greece in large part to help Mussolini and to stabilize this southern front, and were quite successful in doing so. The problem was that they had lost over a month of precious time in their plannings for the invasion of the Soviet Union. The invasion that was to have begun in the spring was launched on June 22, 1941. 129 days, years to the day after Napoleon launched his invasion of Russia in 1812. It was the largest military campaign in human history to that point. Before German troops crossed the frontier into the Soviet Union, they were issued a special commissar order. A verbal order had been given by Hitler, which was then translated by the High Command of the Army, which indicated to all soldiers entering the Eastern Front that this was not to be a normal military campaign, that the law, international law, did not apply, that this was an ideological war to the death, a war of extermination. It was them or us, the Nazis maintained. The enemy, Hitler argued in this commissar order, were the commissars of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, partisans, and Jews. No distinction was to be made between the three. And no quarter was to be given. No bow to any kind of international law. It was a war of annihilation against the Bolsheviks and against Judeo-Bolshevism, as Hitler put it. The order, and I'll read it because of the chilling nature of it. Army instructions on June 4, 1941. Quote, Bolshevism is the mortal enemy of the National Socialist German people. Germany's struggle is directed against the destructive ideology and its carriers. This struggle demands ruthless and energetic measures against Bolshevik agitators, guerrillas, saboteurs, Jews, and the complete elimination of every active or passive resistance. This was to be a very different kind of war than the war Germany was waging in the West. The initial successes of Operation Barbarossa were absolutely staggering. The Russians were caught off guard. Stalin had not wanted to believe that he would be betrayed by Hitler. Three army groups were making stunning headway, capturing hundreds of thousands of Russian prisoners and killing hundreds of thousands more. Army Group North had as its objective Leningrad. Army Group Center headed toward Moscow, and Army Group South toward the southern Ukraine, toward the Crimea. By the end of September, Kiev was in the hands of Army Group Center. Leningrad was besieged in the north, and Odessa and the Crimea were taken by November. At this point, in early November 1941, Hitler gave orders for the German economy to return to a peacetime footing. Peacetime schedules of production now were to be reintroduced in Germany, since the war was obviously coming to a close. By December 4th, the lead elements of the German army were on the outskirts of Moscow, and on the night of December 5th and 6th, these German army units reached the suburbs of Moscow and through binoculars were able to see the spires of the Kremlin. But something had gone slightly wrong with German calculations. The planning for a blitzkrieg meant that those German troops that invaded the Soviet Union were wearing denim uniforms. The temperature in late November, early December hit 36 below zero Fahrenheit in Russia as the rain and the mud turned into ice and into snow. German soldiers were freezing to death in foxholes that they had dug in the forward positions. On the night of December 5th, December 6th, the Red Army launched a completely unexpected counterattack before Moscow that sent the Germans reeling. The Russians almost made a massive breakthrough in that counterattack, which did catch the Germans completely unaware. The counterattack of the Red Army on that night marks a major turning point in the war. The end of the Blitzkrieg phase of the war had come. The counterattack of the Red Army meant that there would be no easy knockout blow of the Soviet Union, that the Blitzkrieg was over, that Germany was now in a war of annihilation that would have no hope of an easy or quick end. Moreover, events all the way across the globe, just a day or so later, on December 7th, 1941, with a Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, also changed the complexion, the scope, scale, and quality of the war. And 4 days after the attack on Pearl Harbor, Hitler accommodated Franklin Roosevelt by declaring war on the United States. It is not at all clear that Roosevelt would have had a very easy time convincing the Congress to go along with a war in Europe as well as in the Far East at this point, but Hitler solved that problem for the United States. The German army was aghast that Hitler had done this, I might add. The German Navy, quite happy, since it allowed them to attack American ships that were serving Great Britain. But the military now had an awful sense that a drastic mistake had been made. And within the German population, as one reads the Gestapo reports, this sense of tremendous foreboding that now the war in the Soviet Union was going to go on and on and on, and now the United States had entered the war again. Germany's worst nightmare had become true. The war in the East was also an ideological war for another reason. The war in the East marks the onset of racial war conducted by the Nazis. In January of 1939, on January 30th to be exact, the anniversary of Hitler's appointment as Chancellor, Hitler, speaking to the Reichstag, made the following public statement. One more thing I would like to state now on this day, memorable perhaps not only for us Germans. I have often been a prophet in my life and was generally laughed at. During my struggle for power, the Jews primarily received with laughter my prophecies that I would someday assume the leadership of the state and thereby of the entire Volk, and then, among many other things, achieve a solution of the Jewish problem. I suppose that meanwhile, the then resounding laughter of Jewry in Germany is now choking in their throats. Today I will be a prophet again. If international finance Jewry within Europe and abroad should succeed once more in plunging the peoples into a world war, then the consequences will not be the Bolshevization of the world and thereby a victory of Jewry, but on the contrary, the destruction of the Jewish race in Europe. That on January 30th, 1939, before the war had begun. The invasion of Poland and, of course, the Soviet Union would put Germany in control of Europe's largest Jewish communities. In October of 1939, Heinrich Himmler was named Reichskommissar for the Strengthening of German Folkdom, a new title that gave him responsibility for Nazi racial policy in the occupied territories. Himmler delegated that authority to Reinhard Heydrich in the Reichssicherheitshauptamt, where SS specialists were already at work on finding a solution to the so-called Jewish question. Immigration, the policy of pre-war Germany, would now become expulsion. In a memorandum dated September 19, 1939, entitled The Jewish Question in the Occupied Territories, Heydrich laid out the foundations of National Socialist policy. In those territories annexed by Germany, all non-Germans were to be expelled from those territories. Those territories were to be cleansed of all non-Aryan elements in preparation for future settlement by Germans. This meant evacuating all Slavs and Jews to the so-called Government General of Poland, a new sort of puppet state established by the Nazis. It was created on October 12, 1939 as a kind of dumping ground for Poles expelled from those parts of Poland to be annexed by Germany. a dumping ground also for Jews, also from the same occupied territories. Moreover, all Jews were to be rounded up and concentrated in a few selected urban areas. Heydrich's September 19th memorandum suggested that this ghettoization, which was the term that was then used, was not the final aim, but represented an intermediate step. These concentration centers, or ghettos, were to be located near major rail lines, hinting that further transport was considered. It was at roughly this time, early on in the war, that the idea of some sort of Jewish reservation, as they put it, somewhere in the Lublin district of Poland, was openly discussed as a final solution. Responsibility for executing this policy was placed in the hands of special SS units, the so-called Einsatzgruppen, or special commando units of the SS. Units that had been developed for the invasion of Austria. They were men with special training, special indoctrination in Nazi racial policy, numbering about 3,000 men. They were not only highly trained in a military sense, but also really represented the most heavily indoctrinated ideological core of the party. It is estimated that approximately 1 million people were rounded up and forced into ghettos in the general government of Poland in 1939 and early 1940. In fact, by October 1939, the SS had begun deportations of Jews from Austria and Czechoslovakia to the general government. And in a signal of the radical Nazi racist doctrine that I've argued was at the center of their ideology, children with Aryan characteristics were now being selected in Czechoslovakia, Poland, and other parts of occupied Europe to be brought back to Germany, to be raised in special SS children's homes, children that were blonde with blonde hair, blue eyes, and the sorts of characteristics that the SS associated with the Aryan folk. Problems with the scheme of settling Jews in the government general of Poland emerged relatively quickly. The army high command was appalled by the sheer brutality of the Einsatzgruppen operating in Poland, who moved in right after the Wehrmacht troops, prompting complaints to various National Socialist officials, including Himmler and to Hitler personally. The army complained that these Einsatzgruppen, these special SS commando units, had disrupted the front. They were not clearly integrated into the chain of command. And the army, at least in the Polish campaign, expressed their concern about the frightful brutality that characterized the actions of these groups. As the war continued and spread to the West in 1940, the Governor General of this new Polish satellite state complained that the government general was being reduced to little more than a dumping ground, that he wasn't going to be able to maintain control of the situation for long. He would be unable to master the situation, he argued, if these trends continued, and that some other solution was going to have to be found. The government general of Poland simply could not act as a dumping ground for the entire Jewish population of Europe. By October 1940, the problem had become particularly acute, since Jews were being deported from Western Europe now to the government general. And it was in this situation that Himmler ordered the construction of a camp, a permanent camp, to go along with one already in existence at Auschwitz in Poland. And in early 1941, before the invasion of the Soviet Union, he ordered its commandant to expect up to 30,000 inmates. But still, no ultimate solution was in sight. The SS at this point was considering several options. In February 1940, the Jewish reservation idea seems to have been approved by Goering. The idea somehow circulates in the Nazi hierarchy that maybe the thing to do is to create somewhere, either in Poland, and then later they talked about somewhere beyond the Urals, out beyond the Urals, somewhere in Central Asia, some sort of Jewish state in which all the Jews from Western Europe could be settled. In February 1940, this idea of a Jewish reservation seems to have been approved by Goering, by Himmler, by Frank, the governor of the government general of Poland, but was finally dropped less than a month later. One of the problems was where actually to put it. At roughly the same time, another plan was put forward within the SS that had been discussed off and on since the outbreak of the war. The idea of settling Europe's Jews somewhere in Africa. In fact, incredible as it sounds, the Nazis began plans for the possible deportation of the entire Jewish community of Europe to the former French colony of Madagascar. This was the so-called Madagascar plan. And as strange and as impossible as it sounds, it is obviously far less strange, far less impossible than the ultimate solution that the Nazis would hit upon. The Nazis were quite serious about this idea. In May of 1940, Himmler had written a memorandum to Hitler on, quote, the treatment of foreign nationals in the East, in which he stated, and I quote, I hope to see the concept of Jews completely obliterated with the possibility of a large migration of all Jews to Africa or else to a colony. Close quote. Certainly the SS, and particularly Heydrich and the people in the Reichssicherheitshauptamt, the central office of the SS, drafted numerous memoranda on issues of international law, international transport, in pursuance of this option. But as 1940 turned to 1941, confusion reigned in National Socialist racial policy. The Madagascar plan proved to be increasingly implausible, largely because Britain had not been knocked out of the war, and it was going to be difficult to think about arranging transport of the Jews down to Madagascar. While these policy options were being discussed in a top-secret way among the leadership of the SS, another set of decisions in another area of policy, apparently unrelated to events in Poland or to Jewish policy, took form that would come to play an enormously important role in the evolution of the so-called final solution of the Holocaust. In the spring of 1939, the Nazis in Germany had initiated a program, the so-called euthanasia program, in which, working on the basis of the notion of racial hygiene, that the people, the Volkskörper, the body of the people, had to be cleansed of all unhealthy elements. A special unit with SS personnel had begun to identify children, in the first instance, mentally retarded children, children with handicaps, speech impediments, children of alcoholic parents who might be carrying the seed of alcoholism. These children were to be isolated, identified by the social services bureaus of Germany, and 21 special children's departments were set up in specially selected hospitals to determine the fate of these children who had already been deemed, quote, racially valueless. The German term is even more terrifying. The German term is lebensunwertes Leben, life unworthy of life. These were children who carried degenerative genes, the Nazis believed, and had to be dealt with. The head of this program, a man by the name of Dr. Leonardo Conti, asked Hitler, before actually taking steps to eliminate these children, asked for written authorization from the Führer. Hitler refused and Conti resigned. It's very instructive that Hitler refused to give a written order. It's deniability already at work. Hitler wanted no part of a written document, but the impetus for the policy clearly came from the highest sources of the German government. In 1940, this program was expanded to cover the adult insane or handicapped and was run out of an office in Hitler's chancellery itself. It is estimated that over 5,000, quote, racially valueless children would die in the first few months of the program, and between 80,000 to 100,000 mentally defective or handicapped adults would be killed, either by injection or, in 1941, by poison gas. The first experiments with poison gas were made in the euthanasia program in late 1939. 20 to 30 patients were taken into shower stalls and gassed using Cyclon B gas. The program was halted in August of 1941 due to a public outcry. Word got out. These installations were in Germany. Parents received letters back saying, after attempts to save your child, she died on the operating table due to complications. But two, there was too much loose talk. These things were going on inside of Germany. Too many people were directly involved. Too many of the victims were German, and this was happening in Germany. As a result, a number of mothers, actually, went down to protest at Gestapo headquarters about this, and the regime backed off. It temporarily halted the euthanasia program in August of 1941. In August of 1941, however, German troops were deep inside the Soviet Union, and indeed the war against Russia would profoundly affect National Socialist racial policy. We've already cited Hitler's infamous Commissar Order, in which he equated partisans, Bolsheviks, and Jews, clearly indicating that the war against Russia was a crusade against Bolshevism and world Jewry, as Hitler put it. The army in the Soviet Union was given very clear instructions. These Einsatzgruppen of the SS that moved in just behind the troops were operating on special orders from the Reichsfuhrer SS, Heinrich Himmler, who was himself acting on direct orders of the Führer. The army was to step aside to allow the Einsatzgruppen to do what they needed to do to accomplish their special mission. And if the army could be of help, the army was encouraged to do so. All over the Eastern Front in the summer of 1941, these Einsatzgruppen conducted a bloodbath. The scenes of horror as entire villages were burned, entire Jewish communities taken out and shot, pushed into mass graves, became the norm for the war in the Soviet Union in the summer of 1941. But the mass shootings of Jews, partisans, and Bolsheviks was too sloppy. It was too open. Too many people saw it. The troops saw it. The enemy saw it. It was too problematic. And in the early summer or early fall of 1941, personnel from the euthanasia program were transferred to the Eastern Front, where they began experimenting with the use of poison gas in mobile gas vans that were taken by the Einsatzgruppen to the various areas of their operations. In September 1941, Himmler ordered the first mass gassings at Auschwitz. The first victims were 600 Russian prisoners of war on whom the Nazis would experiment. In the summer of 1941, perhaps intoxicated by his apparent victory over the Soviet Union, Hitler, it seems absolutely clear, issued a verbal order to Himmler to seek what was now being called a final solution to the Jewish problem in Europe. The date is uncertain, and it's not clear exactly what the order entailed. It may very well have been as vague as almost all of these Führer orders were. But it certainly applied to all of the Eastern European Jews and by implication could be expanded to the entire Jewish population of Europe. On July 31st, 1941, Heydrich received authorization from Göring to prepare for a total solution. In fact, Göring issued the order. The order was probably written by Heydrich. Göring signed it as a result of his position in the four-year plan. There's no Hitler signature on this. Again, I think deniability being the key. At this point, the old policy of what the Nazis euphemistically called resettlement was still in place for German and Western European Jews. But Heydrich at some point in the late summer must have come to the conclusion about the most effective course of action. He drew on the three existing policies and institutions of Nazi racial policy. The concentration camp system, that had been effective for political prisoners in Germany could be duplicated in the East, not inside of Germany, but in occupied Poland in particular. Forced immigration would continue. Resettlement would be the euphemism for the transport of European Jews all over Europe to these resettlement camps or concentration camps now to be established as permanent installations on the Eastern Front. And the experience of the euthanasia program with gas and the Einsatzgruppen on the Eastern Front added the third dimension. What Heydrich now was embarked upon was a systematic plan for the physical elimination of the Jewish population of Europe. This was to be the final solution to the Jewish question. Did Hitler give a specific order to initiate such a program? David Irving, the British historian, has issued at one point a reward for anyone who could show a direct written link of Hitler to the final solution or to the Holocaust. It was an easy wager to make because Hitler did not sign orders. He was not a man who committed himself to paper on matters like this and never would have. Indeed, it was forbidden to speak of this final solution in Hitler's presence. But given the structure of the National Socialist State, all Hitler had to do was to give a nod to Heydrich or Himmler for them to launch their scheme. And certainly by late summer, both acted as if they had received a direct order or a green light from Hitler. Both spoke explicitly of a Führer order. And it's clear from testimony that by October, a plan to use the existing camps for mass extermination using poison gas had taken shape. In November, Hitler told one Foreign Office official that, quote, the destruction of the Jews is being planned. Now the destruction of the Jews is imminent. And an invitation to a top-secret conference at the Berlin suburb of Wannsee was sent to party and state agencies for a meeting to be held on December 9th, 1941, in which Heydrich would lay out the implications for all of these agencies to be involved in this Endlösung or Gesamtlösung, final solution of the Jewish question. That meeting had to be postponed to January 20th because of the Soviet counterattack before Moscow and also the American entry into the war. But on January 20th, 1942, Heydrich laid out what the final solution would be for this select group of Nazi officials. At that conference presided over by Heydrich, it was made clear that resettlement meant physical extermination, that the special concentration camps would not be resettlement camps, but Vernichtungslager, death camps, that these camps were recreated in Poland and others expanded to handle the hundreds and thousands, indeed millions, who would be transported there. Many, Heydrich remarked, would die in transit. Others would simply be worked to death as slave labor. Others still would be liquidated. In early 1942, camps then were established at various places on the Eastern Front, in Belzec, in Treblinka, and of course at Auschwitz, which already held Russian prisoners of war. The need for secrecy was emphasized throughout the Nazi chain of command on this issue. Why? Number one, the Nazi high command was convinced that the German public wasn't ready to deal with this information. Only genuine National Socialists can be trusted, and in fact, Himmler argued, only top-ranking SS officials could really be trusted with this information. Second, there was the problem of foreign propaganda. What would the Allies do with the information that the Germans had embarked upon such a ghastly project? And third, and certainly not last in importance, was that secrecy was a key. The ignorance of the victim of the fate awaiting them was absolutely essential. People had to be kept in ignorance of the fate that awaited them. Otherwise, the rounding up and transport of Jews to these death camps in the East would have been terribly difficult indeed. The procedures employed would be the same in each of these installations. Mothers, small children, the old, and the infirm were on principle deemed unfit for work and were marched instantly into the bunkers at Birkenau and the other Vernichtungslager. They were marked for death from the beginning. 10% of each arriving shipment, as the Nazis put it, of Jews would be set aside for work and simply worked to death. All would be instructed to undress. Women and girls had their hair cut and then were marched between camp guards to the shower rooms. After a long journey, it was necessary, the Nazis reassured their victims. It was necessary to be deloused and to have a bath. The Nazis made their calculations carefully. People were rammed in, one person per square foot. into the gas chambers and then gas released from above. The gassing itself could take anywhere from 10 to 30 minutes, with the screams of agony in some cases going on even longer. Between 1942 and January of 1945, between 6 and 8 million Jews perished in such camps, and millions more, Russians, Poles, Gypsies, homosexuals, and others, fell victim to Nazi racial policy. This was the true radical essence of Nazi racial policy, the true radical essence of National Socialism. Race had become more important than nationality. A master race was going to be created out of the genetic material that the Nazis rounded up and that the SS maintained. It wasn't the Germans, even in the most final analysis, that the Nazis were interested in preserving. It was a racial core to be found within the SS that would be bred with blonde-haired, blue-eyed women who were brought back to Germany to be bred with these SS officers. As this unbelievable human tragedy was unfolding, the tide of the war began to shift. The Battle of Stalingrad in the East from September of 1942 to January 1943 marks the turning point of the war in the East. And, of course, in the following year, in June, the Western Allies would invade, the Normandy invasion, D-Day, and the Third Reich began to reel. By the end of 1944, the Russians were pressing relentlessly onward from the east, while in the west the Anglo-American armies pushed outward from the Normandy beachheads. By the end of January, the Russians had pushed into Germany itself, and by April they stood on the Oder River less than 100 miles from Berlin. By March 23rd, the Ruhr had fallen, the Rhine was crossed, and the Allies began the closing of the vice on the Nazis. It was at this point that the ideological core of National Socialism was revealed in all its grisly and inhuman brutality. In early April, the American Third Army liberated Buchenwald, 5 miles from Weimar. This wasn't even one of the big death camps. And yet, the horrors that the soldiers saw left them speechless. On April, the British freed 55,000 inmates miraculously still alive in Belsen. The Russians, of course, had already liberated Auschwitz, where mass graves, bodies piled in heaps, the living hardly more than skeletons, gas chambers, some of them still clogged with bodies, storage bins of gold extracted from teeth, balls of women's hair, spectacles, dentures, clothing, and in one camp, thousands of pairs of baby's shoes, all delivered over the harvest of the Third Reich. By April 25th, the Russians had reached Berlin, and on April 30th, 1945, Adolf Hitler committed suicide in his bunker in the Reich Chancellery in Berlin. In his political testament, dictated shortly before he committed suicide, Hitler proved himself to be unregenerate to the last. He closed his political life with one last scalding expression of the hatred that had driven him throughout his political career. He wrote, and I quote, "It is not true that I or anyone else in Germany wanted war in 1939. It was desired and provoked exclusively by those international statesmen who were either of Jewish ancestry or who worked for Jewish interests. Centuries may pass, but out of the ruins of our cities and cultural monuments, hatred will again rise against the people who are ultimately responsible for our misery, international Jewry and its accomplices." On May 2nd, 1945, the Third Reich ceased to exist. When the last Anglo-American bomb had been dropped on Central Europe and the last Russian shell had landed, and the German people began emerging from their hiding places to survey the smoking heaps of rubble that had once been Berlin or Dresden or Hamburg, there must have been a moment, however fleeting, when the grisly reality of all that had happened fell in upon them, and they asked themselves the question, how had it ever come to this? It was a question that must have haunted those ghost-like human shells that suffered the unspeakable agonies of Auschwitz or Buchenwald or Treblinka. It must have come to them in millions of ways, in the endless days and nights, in boxcars, or barracks, or prison cells, or in the gas chambers themselves, when the world had become one long, shrieking nightmare. For the Germans, that haunting question was accompanied by an enormous burden of guilt, shame, and horror at what was done in the name of the German people. For them, no less than the victims of National Socialism, victims whose only crime was to have been born a Jew, or a Pole, or a Russian, there's another legacy, a legacy that must be ours as well. It is a political, but even more, a moral imperative that this must never happen again. In our own feeble way, we've tried to explain events in Germany, to seek answers, or at least to pose questions about the rise of Nazism. But the story, I would argue, is not a unique story about Germany. Its lessons, its dangers, apply to all of us, touch all of us, especially those of us who live in democratic societies. Be vigilant about your rights. Care about the rights and fundamental human dignity of others. When the rights of any group, no matter how small or how marginal, are violated, your liberty is put at risk. When we cast about in horror and have to ask the question, how did it ever come to this? That, more than the details of the politics, more than the social developments, more than the economics, more than the theories, is the point of this exercise. Forewarned, let us hope, is indeed forearmed. Thank you.